Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for spending some time with me this hour. To Kill a Mockingbird, the 1960 novel by Harper Lee, deals with racial injustice, childhood innocence, and the pain and violence wrought by ignorance. Both the novel and the 62 film adaptation have endured as American cultural icons, featuring one of the most memorable characters, the small-town lawyer with a big brain, Atticus Finch. Writer Aaron Sorkin took on the daunting task of adapting the classic novel to the stage. The play opened on Broadway last December to critical acclaim and has been broken box office records ever since. Joining us now to discuss To Kill a Mockingbird are Celia Keenan-Bolger, who plays Scout. Hi, Celia.
Hi, Allison.
Gideon Glick, who plays Dill. Hi, Gideon.
Hi, Allison.
And Benga Akinabe, who plays Tom Robinson. Hi, Benga.
Hi, Allison.
So we were sharing before the point about I took a friend to the show on Sunday who's a lawyer, and she was really, really into it. And you were sharing with me that lawyers love the show.
I've never, ever done a stage door, like when you sign autographs afterwards, where it wasn't, like the majority of people weren't like 14-year-old teenage girls. Mm-hmm. But on this one, I would say the combination of lawyers who just wait, they don't even need an autograph, they just want to say that they've been moved by the experience, and people from the South, where I feel like I've never done a Broadway show where there it felt like people were having their first experience of seeing a Broadway show, that they specifically came to New York because they love To Kill a Mockingbird, that I was like, oh, the reach of this play, I mean, it's such a testament to the novel, mm-hmm. but that the reach of this play is actually bigger than anything that I've been a part of before, as far as drawing an audience in.
Why do you think lawyers are so drawn to it, Benga?
I think it gives a very real depiction of how how the justice system can work and also go awry. Mm-hmm. And some of the frustrations that lawyers, especially lawyers that work on social justice issues, face, they see it reflected in this book. They see it reflected on the stage. And then you have Atticus, obviously played by Jeff, and Celia. They're kind of breaking down this the what's going on as far as the court and the argument between them, and then the arguments about the law and how it should work in this town. It resonates with, I think it resonates with lawyers. It resonates with everyone, but particularly lawyers, because they respect it for, yeah, and that's credit to Harper Lee and also to Sorkin for how grounded they made this material.
I can imagine if you're a young kid and you wanted to be a lawyer, Atticus Finch would be somebody you would point to. I want to do that. I want to be that guy.
Totally. And I think also this version, it spends so much time, like we start in the courtroom where the novel sort of starts in Macomb, and that we sort of cut right to the courtroom. Mm-hmm. So I think there's an immediate in that the way that we're telling the story is through this case. And so I wonder if that's also a part of where the lawyers are like, oh, this is like the main part of how we're telling the story, yeah. So that they really feel a way in.
Gideon, when was the first time you encountered To Kill a Mockingbird?
It was in the seventh grade. And it was a pretty transformative experience for me because it was how I learned how to be a critical reader and a critical thinker. So mm-hmm. it was how I could suss out metaphor and simile and theme. And so the book has kind of been with me. I'm an avid reader, and the book is with me every time I read a book. Mm. So it's been just a tremendous part of my development.
As an avid reader, when you heard it was going to be adapted, did you have any concern? not talking about Aaron's talent, because we know it's big.
Yeah, I'm always concerned. This book means so much to people. It is so important to the nation. It's important to people's development, as it was for me. And people are very, very particular about what it should be and what it shouldn't be. So yes, I was reticent. What I find really remarkable is how people have been receiving it. Mm-hmm. And people love to say at the stage door, yeah, I did not want to like this. I did not want to like adults playing kids. I did not want to like any of this. And then they do.
it's, you know what people are moved by it when they name their children. A lot of people name their children Atticus and Scout.
They're such good names.
They are. During the previews, there was like out at the stage door, I was leaving, and there was this beautiful little girl with her little sister and the parents standing up, behind them, and the girls came up to me and asked for an autograph, and they told me how much they loved the the play. And then the father said, "Tell him what your name is." And the little girl said, "Oh, my name is Atticus." And I'm like, I love that. Like, I'm my family's Nigerian. I want my children all to have Nigerian names. But I'm seriously considering, like throwing in, as if I have a daughter, an Atticus in there as far as a middle name or something like that. It was just so beautiful. I think about it all the time.
When was your first encounter with To Kill a Mockingbird?
Excerpts of it in middle school. I didn't go to a regular public school, and so like education was, the teachers tried, but they were mainly concentrating on keeping kids in line for behavioral issues. And so they had this one teacher who was going to like show us, we didn't read the whole book, but show us a little bit of what we would normally be getting at this age in another school. And so we watched a bit of the movie, and it was powerful to see Gregory Peck there with Scout and having their interactions about what's going on in this town, and then reading some of the excerpts of the school, of the book. I loved it, and I watched the movie later. I didn't watch the movie while doing this process, but I remember loving the movie when I did watch it years ago.
Celia, did you go back and read the book or watch the movie?
I did go back and read the book. I was too intimidated by Mary Badham's performance to go back and watch the movie, where I was like, that little girl was a genius. So I will only be in a shame spiral if I go and watch how good she is. And, you know, like there are parts like that little scowl, like her face, it's like indelibly printed on my brain. So I was like, yeah, you don't need to revisit that, because you'll try to do some little version of what she did. And I, you know, this character, this version of Scout, is a sort of, it's different than the movie. But I read as much as I could find about Harper Lee and about that time period. There's a really amazing book by Joe Crispino called, Atticus Finch? Atticus Finch, a biography. Yeah. That's a lot about the time period of in 1934, of just what was going on in the South.
By Harper Lee's father.
Yes, and their relationship. Which was really, really helpful. This was a piece where I felt like you really needed to do the research, because the novel is so beloved that we all have access to the novel. So I was like, I have to take it the next step so that I know a little bit more about these characters than just the random audience member who's coming in.
My guests were Celia Keenan-Bilger and Gideon Glick and Benga Akanabe. We're talking about To Kill a Mockingbird, which is currently on Broadway. Good luck getting tickets.
Yeah.
Did you work with a dialect coach? That is such a specific Southern accent.
Kate Wilson is amazing. She's amazing. She teaches at Juilliard, and she was a great dialect coach, but also this great warm energy of a heart to have around, especially dealing with this material. So it's wild how in this profession there's a lot of negative reinforcement, and that can help, like just being scared to death to get it right. but she came with a lot of positive reinforcement, which is I saw all these dialects growing and bubbling while we were workshopping, and it was just, yeah, she was awesome.
How was your work with the dialect coach, Gideon?
It was very interesting, because I in the book, Dill is from Mississippi, and in the show he's from Bayou Blue, but I knew I really wanted to have, I wanted him to feel different. I wanted his accent to be different. I wanted it to have this, I wanted it to be grand and have this kind of drawl that was different from the other citizens, because he's not from Macomb. And Kate was really extraordinary in expanding upon that and also blending it in with what everybody else was doing.
Why did you want him to feel grand? Is that because in his mind, his internal world is grand?
Yes, absolutely. He creates such a narrative for himself, and it's his way of winning, or it's his way of how he thinks he wins over other people. He ingratiates himself with these tall tales, and it's really just masking a deep insecurity and a cruel upbringing.
and for Scout, because Scout has got to be, she's got to be our narrator, mm-hmm. so she needs to be clear,
right.
but she's also a little kid,
mm-hmm.
and with a Southern accent.
Mm-hmm. It's like a lot there.
It's a lot there.
And I think what was so nice about what Kate did is that she, there was no, as is the truth with accents, you know, all over our country, that there's not one way that people speak if you're from a town. And even we went to Monroeville, where Harper Lee was born, and I was like, the main reason was just to like listen to how people talked,
cool.
and to try to like figure out what that sounds like. And I like had lunch with a family, and the difference between how the father talked and the woman who was my age, his daughter, spoke was completely different. That I was like, oh, she's just, and I, she just had way less of an accent. And so in that way, Kate said often, she was like, you know, it's not that everybody on stage needs to sound the same, but we need to sound like we are in the same play,
mm-hmm.
and that we know what this town is, and we know why the farmers sound different mm-hmm. from the townsfolk. And so that part of it, and then also just trying to sort of modulate for myself, like, what does it sound like when I'm sort of looking back on the story, and what does it sound like when I'm inside of the story as an 8-year-old kid, and trying to figure out, you know, how to play that.
Let's talk about you guys playing kids.
Okay.
It's interesting that you said that people at the stage door weren't so sure it was going to work. In the initial discussions about grown-ups playing these little kids, can you describe some of the direction you got from Bartlett Shear about this?
Yeah, I think what was most helpful is that we all kind of, it wasn't about characterization. It wasn't about these external factors of how we hold our body and how we pitch our voice. It was about the stakes of the scenes and what motivates these characters. And you know, that we're in the South. It's the 30s. There's no television. What activates these kids?
Mm.
And it was from there that the body started following suit, and so did the voices. And Bart was a really wonderful conductor of all that.
Yes. And I think it was, you know, you're always treading that line, because I think the truth is, like, people really don't want to watch adults play kids, including myself. So you have to figure out a way. And I think it also is a real testament to what Aaron was able to do, that he wrote something that supported, like, the language feels just sophisticated enough that you don't feel like these kids are idiots, but and that, because they have such a good sense of humor, that it's doing a lot of work for you, and that is sort of exactly what Gideon was saying. It's like the imagination just goes to, like, what if you're a kid with nothing to do, how do you spend your day? And that really ended up influencing the way that we would shape the scenes and how we would think about, you know, the characters.
What's something that you do physically on stage to telegraph to the audience that you're playing a kid?
I sometimes imitate Jeff, because Atticus, you all know, because he really looks up to Atticus, and I think he thinks of himself as kind of this, like, young little philosopher. And so I sometimes try to emulate his body pattern, his body behavior,
mm-hmm.
and that ends up, I think, being, you know, very youthful.
What about for you, Celia?
Yeah, I feel like I almost never walk in this play. Like,
you guys stomp.
Yeah, we are running and
stomping and
galloping and running. And that was like something that I was just like, oh yeah, kids, like, given the like opportunity, they're not so interested in walking. But I was like, that's a good way just to be like, they move through the world differently. And usually, and it was also helpful, because when we're playing adults, then you're like, okay, now we can sort of like take the pace of everything yeah. down. And then when we're the kids, it's like, all right, and now we have to like ramp it up.
Which is that sense of adventure.
Mm-hmm.
It goes
yes.
back to how are we entertaining ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting. There's an audience member, I liked having adults play the kids, because I always worry about kids on stage. I don't know if it's the mom in me or what. Like, it's such a serious play, and it's mm-hmm. so important to make these certain points. I thought, like, oh, the adults, they can do it.
You don't feel worried for us.
I really
and
didn't.
I also think it's so hard to do the same thing 8 times a week. And especially if you're getting positive feedback, if you're a kid, to not modulate your performance for an audience. Like, if you're getting mm-hmm. the laughs, or that it's really hard to be sort of rigorous about how the play was built if you're 8 years old. Yeah. I mean,
you're
it's
getting
hard
a laugh
to do that there's... when you're... Exactly.
Yeah.
Go
for the hammy
it's
laugh,
hard for
right?
us yeah, to modulate. I'll say also it's really helpful in the... Because people have so many preconceived notions about what this piece is, when you come to this show and you see three adults come out and then play kids, you go, oh, we're in a different space. Mm-hmm. This is theater. And I think it's very, very helpful for the audience.
One of the other differences from the book, there's many, is that when we never see the jurors, bingo. There's these empty chairs. What do you think that adds to the theatrical nature of the piece? What do you think it adds for the audience and for you as an actor? Because you're the person who's on trial.
I think
Tom is the person.
I think it allows the audience to, like, this play allows the audience, forces the audience to engage on many levels. Like, you can't just sit and watch this show. You have to judge throughout. You have to take sides. At one point, you have to look at yourself. People leave and they do tons of reflection. Part of that, I think, is looking at the, you know, having this empty juror's box and picturing who would be there as far as this town, picturing themselves there. I'm sure the audience pictures themselves there at certain times. And so, what would I do? The people, and what would the people in this town who would be there? The farmers. So the kids. We call Gideon and Celia and Will the kids. Like, they do a great job of setting up, like, what this town looks like, who these people are, like giving all these facts to the audience at first, and then now run with us. And part of that is, you know, you have these farmers who are all white, who are all male, and this is why they're the ones as jurors and not people of upper or lower class and so on. And so it makes the audience engage in a way that, like, they invest in our show.
Does it free you up as an actor at all? I was wondering, just because the way you're sitting is you're facing one direction and then the jury's over here. And, you know, if you've ever been on jury duty, you realize that the person who's accused often kind of interacts with the jury.
I can't flirt with the jury to get off, so no. But it frees, it's interesting because it does free up to a certain extent, but then you're reminded of the stakes, right? And mm-hmm. so, like, that jury box is like super important. And looking at it, you're like, maybe there's a chance. No, there's no chance. You know, it's like a lot of that's what happens in that jury. Because for a great deal of the play, Atticus is surprisingly winning. So that means he's winning over those jury members. And so, like, who are those people who start out one way and then become swayed, you know? And then it goes a different way. So that's interesting to me to picture and also engage with that box. And when do they become swayed? What happens in the play that does it? How am I surprised that they, like, these 12 white and most likely very racist jurors mm-hmm. are starting to be open a little bit by this argument Atticus is presenting? So how do I see that when I'm looking at them?
Gideon, I'm curious about the music. For folks who haven't seen the play, there's a guitar player on one side of the stage, and it's an organ, mm-hmm. an organ on the other side of the stage. And they sort of weave in and out, but they do something to the narrative, and I'm not sure what it is. Yeah. What do you think it is?
I call it the lubricant. You know, when we did two workshops of the show, and we didn't have the music, and I remember when we first got the music and people were saying, oh, how's rehearsal going? I go, well, we just got the music. And all of a sudden, for me, the show came alive because there are so many scenes and the show kind of bleeds into each other. The scenes bleed into each other and the music is so helpful in making that all cohesive. And I think it's also very helpful for our narration and our journey when we're around the town, because there isn't a physical town really, it's just a wall, and mm-hmm. it helps amp us up, and it's psychologically potent too.
And I think it really, it locates you in the South. Like, you almost immediately are like, this doesn't sound like what I'm familiar with, mm-hmm. and that it did so much work that Bart talked a lot where he was like, I don't want it to feel like a bunch of New York actors with Southern mm-hmm. accents doing To Kill a Mockingbird. I want us to have a window into this town in 1934. And I think when the musicians came in and Adam started writing the music, I was like, oh, for the first time, I sort of see where we are.
Exactly.
It definitely places us. And it was amazing to see the music being written live in front of us in rehearsal, cool. At least for me, because I'm not used to that. And Adam was we had such a talented musical group. Alan, who plays the guitar, Kim Grisby, who's a musical director. And just to see them all just like form this other structure to the play, and then and it's integrated into like what we do. It's amazing.
Also, when we started previews, that hymn at the very end that everybody sings wasn't even a part of the show. Like, that was something that came later, where they felt like we need something to sort of tie everything up. And so that was like a beautiful addition, like at probably the second week or the end of the first week of previews, that the music just like elevated the whole experience, I think.
My guests are Benga Akanabe, Gideon Glick, and Celia Keenan-Bolger. We're talking about To Kill a Mockingbird, which is now playing at the Schubert Theater. We'll have more of our conversation after a quick break. Yeah. We're back. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My guests are Benga Akanabe, Celia Keenan-Bolger, and Gideon Glick. We're talking about To Kill a Mockingbird, which is currently on Broadway. It's so interesting how the themes of this play just resonate with everything today. Everything politically, how we deal with each other, and specifically the idea of, should we tolerate tolerance, right? That's a big, big issue in the play. As you have those conversations, do you guys have conversations about this off stage? Did you have conversations about it before the show started?
I think we spoke a lot about it during the year-long workshop, which was an amazing process, like to just get around and have this really great text and these really smart actors and Bart, like, so just chopping it up, talking about the times, talking about race issues, talking about language. I don't know about now. I think a lot of that work was done then, and so we all kind of have this shared experience of what the stakes are on and off stage and the details of the play. And we know, like, it's unfortunately very relevant. It was relevant when it was written. It's relevant now. I mean, I always say it shows us. Oh, I forgot. It's one of those stations you can't curse on. It shows us how messed up we can be as people, but how wonderful we can be as a nation. Like as far as what we can aspire to. So that's one of the beautifully complicated things about the book, and particularly this play, especially Aaron's take on the play, on that story.
This is the first time I thought about Atticus having a weakness because he is so focused on being civil and everybody gets their point of view and we have to respect a point of view if we don't agree with it. And those are interesting conversations to have in these times. And to his point, Calpurnia has a much bigger part, and she's like, she doesn't say check your white privilege, but that's what she says essentially in the play.
Mm-hmm. No matter who you're, I believe in being respectful no matter who you're disrespecting by doing it. I remember when I first heard that, I was like, oh boy, we're taking big swings.
Yeah.
But in a really good way. And I feel like something that's so amazing about being an actor is, I think that was the conversations we had around race in those early workshops were some of the most, at a time when I think all of us were hungry. It was like pretty quick, you know, soon after the election, that I was so hungry to be able to be in a space where you could just have those conversations and have all of these different generations, both of white and black cast members, that were able to talk about, you know, just even the difference between yours and LaTanya's experience. Mm-hmm. And like, we had a lot of conversation around, like, is there too much use of the N-word? Mm-hmm. Would Tom Robinson call himself the N-word? Like, and there were a lot of different takes on it. And just to be able to be in a space with a bunch of other people, and obviously in, you know, the context of the play, but to really break down, like, what does it feel like to be black in this country? What does it feel like to have white privilege in this country? And like, how can we reflect that on stage today was like an incredibly moving part of this process for me.
Yep, part of it was, like, for me, it was also seeing, I agree with her completely, and then also seeing Aaron Sorkin in this process examine his own white privilege, which he did very openly, and I think you can't do this play with the heart that it should have without doing that, you know, and he was from the beginning, he's like, all right, there's this scene. He talks about this often, and I think he's right on the scene in the book and in the movie where you have where the case is lost, everyone leaves, and except for the black people who have to be separated, they're up in the balcony, mm-hmm. and they stand up to honor Atticus, and you know, the Reverend says, stand up, Miss Jean Louise, your father is passing. It's a beautiful scene. It's very moving even now describing it, but it's problematic because it's like, all hail this white savior who did what he should do, and because we need nothing in our lives could ever be right without a white man coming in and making it so. And Aaron and Bart wanted to make sure we addressed and eliminated as many places of elevating the white savior as possible, and then also again dealing with his own privilege and seeing it, you know, in throughout the play. So it was interesting to see someone who has a great deal of privilege do a lot of self-examination through the creation of this play.
Did you want to add anything, Gideon?
Just that, you know, I think what I find really beautiful in this piece is how it kind of mirrors a bit of the experience of when Trump got elected, that there was, we thought, oh, not in this country, in the same way Atticus is not in this town. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, this racism that was always there, that, and with white privilege, we were not so aware of, that has come to the forefront. And that's Calpurnia saying, oh, it's been there the entire time. Mm-hmm. And I think this play is reflecting that experience. And I think Aaron does a good job with that.
Before I let you go, so you folks went to D.C. at the invitation of Speaker Pelosi to perform.
Nancy, call her Nancy. You
can call her Nancy.
You kissed her on the cheek.
I did. I did. Oh, I said she smelled like power and love of country.
What was that experience like for you?
Extraordinary. Yeah. We've been talking about it, that we don't. You do a lot of. You can do field trips with a show to go, you know, to a road conference or something like that. This just doesn't compare. We got to tour the Capitol. We got to perform this show for 350 kids in the Library of Congress.
Oh my God.
It was so gratifying, and it affirms what we do to an extent. It feels like, okay, this is important. This is good work.
And then I think particularly since this last election, there has been a part of me that's like, do I feel embarrassed to be an actor? Like, I think I sometimes feel like, what am I doing? It's like such a selfish, self-serving profession in many ways. And to have an experience, to get to go to D.C. where I felt so valued. I felt like what we were doing was so valued. And I was like, you know, I can feel embarrassed a lot of days, but not today. Like, if Nancy Pelosi and Nina Totenberg want to tell me that what we're making is important work, I believe it. And I think that has been a part of this process also that I could never really have imagined.
It's been amazing. And I'm going to go on a limb and speak for us that we feel that we're adding to the conversation in an important way. I'd say it's the most important play on Broadway right now, and particularly at this time. And then for the speaker to bring us down and for us to be able to give back in D.C. like that, it validated those things. And I often feel like, what am I doing? As this I play for a living. I go out and play for a living. When there are so many things happening in the world that I know I can help with and contribute with. So this play with these people it's been very validating to my soul.
Benga Akinabe, Gideon Glick, and Celia Keenan-Bolger from To Kill a Mockingbird, thanks for coming to the studio.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Stay with us. You're listening to All of It